Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Empathy on trial with the Supreme Court pick this week. GM tips to bankruptcy and nukes and passion on the Korean Peninsula. President Obama nominated Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the High Court. She would be the first Hispanic to serve there.
This wealth of experiences, personal and professional, have helped me appreciate the variety of perspectives that present themselves in every case that I hear.
Some pushback to Sotomayor, especially over her 2001 comment that a wise Latina would reach better judgments than a white male. Here's former GOP Congressman Tom Tancredo.
She appears to be a racist. She said things that are racist in any other context. That's exactly how we would portray it. And there's no one that would get on the Supreme Court saying a thing like that except for a Hispanic woman.
And North Korea tests half a dozen missiles and a nuclear bomb. South Koreans protested the North's nuclear saber-rattling. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What do you say to Sotomayor for the Supreme Court, to GM on the chopping block, to North Korea and its nukes? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ron Brownstein, political director for the Atlantic Media Publishers, writing plenty for the National Journal these days. He's author of The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America. Ron Brownstein, great to have you back.
Tom, glad to be back.
Also from Washington, Margaret Tolev, White House reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. Margaret, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Nice to be here. Hi, Ron.
Great to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ron, and Margaret.
Let's go straight to Sonia Sotomayor, sort of the top headline of the week, and there's a lot to say here. Let's listen to just a little more of her. Here she was after President Obama announced her nomination, standing in the White House. She said that her life experience, from growing up in a Bronx housing project to serving as a federal judge, are big advantages.
It has helped me to understand, respect, and respond to the concerns and arguments of all litigants who appear before me, as well as to the views of my colleagues on the bench. I strive never to forget the real-world consequences of my decisions on individuals, businesses, and government.
Ron Brownstein, we've had several days for this to sink in. What do you make of the nomination, its prospects, and this arc of response from yay to empathy on the one hand to, you heard Tom Tancredo, and he's not the only one there, Newt Gingrich, using the word racism at the other?
Well, I think the overall prospects for the nomination are very strong. First of all, when you look back through the really the last 120 years, we're sort of overconditioned by the Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas experiences to expect full-scale Donnybrooks over presidential nominations to the Supreme Court. In fact, they are much more the exception than the rule. If you take the condition we're in now, when the president's party controls the Senate, we've only had one nominee in that circumstance directly voted down, John Parker under Herbert in the 20th century, John Parker under Herbert Hoover in 1930. Abe Fortas was a similar case where Lyndon Johnson tried to elevate him to Chief Justice at the very end of his presidency, the 11th hour. He was blocked by a semi-filibuster. Mm. And then Harriet Myers had to withdraw in a kind of rebellion within her own party. So I think the first point here is that with Democrats holding 59 or 60 votes by the time this is going to come to the floor, that her odds are overwhelming of being confirmed. And that really frames the choice for Republicans, which is how far do you want to go toward opposing a nominee who is almost certain to be confirmed, particularly when they are, you know, making this historic statement as the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice at a time when the Republican Party, as we've discussed before, Tom, is facing a rapid and potentially very dangerous erosion of their support among Hispanic voters. Obama won two-thirds of them in 2008. as Democrats won a comparable percentage in the congressional elections in 06. So I think the choice here, certainly the line of argument that she is practicing identity politics, both in terms of her public comments, but also this New Haven firefighters case, is something that I think that there are going to be conservatives who want congressional Senate Republicans to push. I think the issue is how many of them will follow them into that fight.
I want to look at that issue. The first response, early response, was pretty positive. I mean, as you say, the GOP is thinking about the polls and looking at this record. Here's Texas Senator John Cornyn praising the nominee, Sonia Sotomayor's personal story on Tuesday. He and many other congressional Republicans, you know, a little reluctant to criticize this woman who would be America's first Latina Supreme Court justice.
It says a lot about what a great country we live in, that somebody that has come from such an humble background and origins has now risen to the top of the legal profession and now is being nominated to the United States Supreme Court. To me, that says great things about our country and the opportunities that are available to anyone who's willing to work hard and sacrifice.
So big thumbs up. But things evolved as the week went on. By the next day, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, Senate Judiciary Committee's ranking Republican, said on the Today Show the GOP has to strike a balance on Sotomayor.
Certainly, the Republican Party needs to broaden its tent and do those the things that are good for outreach. But I just got to tell you, we have an absolute constitutional duty to make sure that any nominee, no matter what their background and how what kind of life story they have, that we examine that so the American people can know that the person we give a lifetime appointment to, we can't even dock their pay once they get in office, that person will be faithful to the law and not allow their personal views to influence decision-making.
Not allow their personal views to influence decision-making. And before you know it, via Gingrich and Tancredo, Margaret Tolove, the word becomes racism. Do you think that has legs, and why would some use it?
In terms of the debate, I don't think it's going to have legs. I don't think you're going to see the Republicans remaining on the judiciary panel tossing that one out during the confirmation hearings. And Tom Tancredo has sort of never stayed away from a fight. I mean, is it true that a white nominee for the Supreme Court, if he started talking about being if there were any comments that could be taken in context or out of context where he was talking about white men being better able to use their experiences to judge stuff, of course there are two standards for things. Of course, you know, you can make the argument that it's not fair, but this is woven so deeply into the fabric of our society, and this is a 54-year-old woman who went to college in the 70s, that, you know, she is, of course, shaped by her life experiences. But I don't think that the racism argument is, forget about going to stick, I don't think it's going to be anything that is used in the context of these confirmation hearings.
But it's still out there. Pat Buchanan on MSNBC calling her an affirmative action candidate, Jack. And then on Bill Bennett's radio show, Weekly Standard editor Fred Barnes, kind of incredible, making the same thing, saying she's an affirmative action baby, basically. Bennett responded, well, she was summa cum laude from Princeton, a pretty big deal. And Bennett said to Barnes, did she get into Princeton on affirmative action, one wonders? Barnes, one wonders. And then summa cum laude, pretty big deal. Barnes says, I guess it is, but, you know, some schools, they kind of give them away like candy, more or less. What do you think of this, Jack?
Well, you know, in his late years, William F. Buckley Jr. was heard to mutter, quote, the kooks are coming back, by which he meant that the kooks he had driven out of the Republican, out of the conservative movement in the 1950s and 60s, and that those days it was the John Birch Society, that something like that was coming back and that there was a kind of dervish wing of the conservative movement forming, and that this wing, really, or group, was holding the Republican Party hostage. And I think you can see that now. I mean, you know, Mark McKinnon, the GOP strategist, has said if Republicans make a big deal of opposing this nomination, we'll be hurling ourselves off the cliff. And yet here you have these talking heads and blatherers without portfolio like Gingrich going around and making these wild charges. And, of course, that's part of the medium that Republican elected officials now have to operate in, and it's as if this movement is and with Rush Limbaugh and so on is sort of taking over their party and defining them just at the moment. As Ron has told us before and again today, they need to move toward the median voter, toward the center.
But Ron, flip it around for a minute and take the concern seriously. I mean, mm-hmm. here it is, 2001. This is at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. This is later published in the Berkeley La Raza Law Journal, where Sotomayor is speaking, and she says, "I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life." And it wasn't, as I read it here in the full speech, it wasn't particularly in regard to some particularly Latina question. It was more general.
Right.
What do you say to that?
Well, where this potentially has some potency and is kind of intriguing politically is in the connection to her record through the New Haven firefighters case, where New Haven threw out a promotion exam for firefighters because no African Americans would have been promoted mm-hmm. under the results. And she was part of a panel that upheld it in a very almost cursory way. Now, you know, there's a throwback aspect to this argument. I almost felt like the soundtrack for the first 48 hours of her nomination should have been Pat Benatar or early Madonna, because we have not really had full-throated arguments about racial preferences and reverse discrimination since the late 70s and yeah. early 80s. Mm-hmm. There was a little flare-up under
throwback.
Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, it's worth noting. It's interesting. And I think if you read the conservative commentators, Charles Krauthammer, Mike mm-hmm. Gerst, and many others, certainly Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh expressing it in the most inflammatory terms, that is a line of argument they want to pursue, that you know, she is an advocate of racial preferences. Look, the fact is that white voters, white Americans, oppose racial preferences. They have for 30 years. It's no different today. But the issue has been less salient for 25 years, and I'm not sure Republicans really want to take on that fight. Certainly George Bush never tried to roll them back in the 8 years that he was president.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. GM in bankruptcy, North Korea's nukes, and Sotomayor tapped for the Supreme Court. Ron Brownstein is with us. Margaret Tolliver is here from McClatchy Newspapers. Jack Beatty's here. Let's get a couple of callers on. Sonia Sotomayor, the judge, Centuria in Columbia, South Carolina. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Tom, thank you for having me. It is such a pleasure to be on your program. Primarily, my take on it is, first of all, I'm in South Carolina, so you know I have a certain view of things already.
Okay.
And the important thing is the judge's qualifications. That's the only thing that matters. That's the only thing that anyone should be looking at. And it's common sense. And I know it's not common because everyone doesn't have them, but common sense says that all of us are shaped by our life experiences, no matter who we are. So the fact that she said that isn't anything to really focus on or parse out her words. My concern is that the right seems to have to work themselves into a frenzy, this is my perception, and try to get others to get on board so they can get legs on any issue. And when you look at the fact that the Republican Party talk about being inclusive, and I think their problem is an image problem from my perspective, and this is because of where I live.
Mm.
Their problem is an image problem. They're inclusive if, .. you have a position on this, that, and the other. Otherwise, they really are not inclusive, and the fact that they are trying to say that her comments were racist is just a smokescreen, and to me, it doesn't have legs. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Centuria, you're hot, and we appreciate your call, and we'll look at it. Let me get one more call out here first from Nashville. Eric, you're on the air.
Hello, great to be on the show. I think that the Republicans should look at how much of a fairly moderate nominee she is. She has voted alongside Bush when he decided not to fund institutions that perform abortions overseas, and was nominated to the Court of Appeals by George H.W. Bush. I think that's something to consider besides her race or things like that. Take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Eric. Looks moderate to you. Margaret Tolliver, what about her place on that spectrum? There have been some complaints from the right, but also some from the left. Yesterday, the big question mark out there was about her view on abortion. The White House going to some lengths this morning to say that here's a quote from Robert Gibbs. I mean, it's in print this morning, saying, about President Obama and Judge Sotomayor. In their discussions, they talked about the theory of constitutional interpretation, generally including her views on enumerated rights in the Constitution, the theory of settled law. He left very comfortable with her interpretation of the Constitution being similar to that of his, and the right. point of reference was abortion.
Well, and I think there's some irony that she would be that she's being nominated to replace David Souter because, as we learned with David Souter, just because you think you know what you're getting doesn't mean you actually know what you're getting. And I think on the abortion issue, there's been enough sort of tangential rulings that she's made that brand her as not entirely predictable on the issue, where she talks about, for example, a case in terms of forced abortions in China where would-be parents would have viewed that as the murder of a child. I think Obama probably has a comfort level with her either, you know, in general because of her background, because of her record, because of the way she's, you know, perceived by other legal scholars and experts. And I would disagree with the caller's idea that she is, you know, sort of a moderate. I think she's to the left of moderate, but especially in terms of discrimination and affirmative action type cases. And I think the previous caller from South Carolina who talked about the cries of racism, et cetera, as being a smokescreen, I honestly don't think that's entirely true either. I think there are a number of legal observers, including some of the ones who have spoken out so actively, who really disagree with ideas like affirmative action and looking ahead, presume that she will rule certain ways, and that makes them uncomfortable. I think what they're expressing is not just entirely political or meant to derail President Obama's nominee. I think it comes from a genuine place. But I think, as we saw in the case of David Souter, and she's a different type of person. She's not as private or as soft-spoken. In many ways, she's just the opposite, but she is certainly independent and has a reputation for not being cowed by what other people expect out of her.
Let's get a call from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Tom, Jack.
Hi.
I have to say I'm kind of bothered by this particular appointment. It's not that she's a bad appointment, but I wished that Obama had chosen someone a little bit more stellar, you know, something along the lines of a Justice Holmes or Brandeis or whatever.
Your standards are pretty high there, Bill.
I understand that, but frankly, I was expecting higher standards with this president, which leads me into the other point. I've become very much disillusioned with President Obama. His lack of transparency concerning torture, the past torture, the past administration, trying to cover up documents, all this other sort of thing, not allowing habeas corpus rights to prisoners and all that. I must tell you, I got less than what I voted for. I guess that's the best way I could possibly sum it up.
What, you wanted more change, more liberal, more left?
I wanted somebody who would uphold his oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. I like open government. I want to know what my government is doing. And to go to court and say, we want these particular memos suppressed, we do not want to reveal what we did in the way of torturing and all this other sort of thing, when all the world knows we did it, we had a golden chance to say, look, this is what we did, these are the people who did it. Maybe we can't prosecute them, but let the chips fall where they may.
Bill, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Ron Brownstein, I mean, what do you say? There is some tacking going on with this president. You hear where Bill's coming from. It's not enough tacking in his direction, but Obama's got a big game he's playing here.
Right. Obama, well, I mean, there is, I mean, you can see in on the in some of the liberal magazines and certainly on the liberal websites, there's kind of a, you know, a buzz of discontent. But from the point of view of a mass phenomenon, it's a rounding error, not even a footnote. I mean, he is looking at extraordinary levels of approval within his own party. In fact, if you look at strong approval, voters who strongly approve of him, about 80% of Democrats say they strongly approve of Obama's performance. That's double the level that Bill Clinton enjoyed at this point. So what Obama's been able to do in the first few months, I think, is rather extraordinary. He's been able to achieve both depth and breadth. You know, he has an approval rating of over 60% among independents, and he has 80% of Democrats strongly approving. You see the same thing on Capitol Hill, where he has been able to begin moving forward some of these key Democratic initiatives like energy, cap and trade, climate change legislation, and also the beginnings of health care, while also broadening his reach into the business community. I mean, we've seen some extraordinary events here in the last few weeks with the utility industry speaking positively about a climate change bill that moved out of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, 10 major auto companies standing behind him who have fought higher fuel economy standards for decades, standing at the Rose Garden with him. And essentially, he is advancing the priorities of his base while broadening his base. And that is pretty sophisticated political management and really, I believe, the formula to how you build a lasting majority. So while there's that kind of grumbling that you have on the call, I think right now it is very much of a minor note in what is in what is a much broader long-term project, of which I think Sotomayor probably is part of. And the opportunity to make this historic statement may have outweighed other factors like looking for a judge of kind of, you know, intergalactic brilliance. But the way they think, they are playing a long game politically.
I'm going to turn to North Korea. Jack, let me get one more call, and I'll get you on Sotomayor. Grant in Arlington, Massachusetts. Grant, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My point was that as much as the Republicans are being, some of the more extreme elements of Republicans are being demonized for possibly going after Sonia, I think the base of the Democratic Party seems to be going after Republicans as being racist to feed their own concerns. It seems like they have to make a point that, oh, my God, the Republicans, look at how uninclusive they are.
Well, I mean, I don't want to say who hit who first, but I mean, I think it was sort of Gingrich and Tancredo who threw the racism word out there, Grant.
But I also remember Schumer getting out there saying, how dare they oppose this nominee?
Yeah,
I have not heard any of the Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee say anything other than, we're going to give this lady a fair shake.
Yeah, those in office, treading a little carefully there, so be careful where we throw the stones. You say we've got it. Jack, we're going to North Korea, but last thoughts on the Supreme Court and Obama's politics here?
Well, you know, to Bill's question and comment, I can imagine the president saying to him, Bill, look, these things that Ron Bronstein was just talking about, stuff the Democratic Party has pushed for decades, national health insurance, cap and trade, not so long, but central to the whole future. These things are moving along. These are major game changers. This is Social Security for our age. And if I made a big issue of the kinds of things you want me to talk about, say putting the photographs out or you know, taking unequivocal positions on prosecuting Bush administration malfactions, if I did those things, I would jeopardize this whole liberal agenda that people like you voted for me overwhelmingly for that reason. So, you know, we have to, in politics, you have to be strategic. You have to subordinate lesser goals and for larger ones. And I think that's what we see with the president doing. And I don't know how Bill would respond to that, but I do think that's what he would say. If I go ahead on these inflammatory matters, I will inflame Republican and conservative opposition, and it will devour or threaten to burn up support such as I have for these larger social changes.
I want to turn to North Korea, a nuclear test the size of Hiroshima this week. Six missile test firings, the sixth just in the last little bit of time here. North Korea saying the ceasefire way back to the Korean War is off. All kinds of stuff going on here. I mean, today, Chinese fishing boats pulling away from the Korean coast in preparation for, or maybe just out of concern for, nobody knows. Maybe this all simmers down. Maybe it doesn't. Here's a little bit of the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, saying that North Korea will pay a price for its actions, saying the U.S. is worried that seaborne cargo may carry weapons.
That's why we're prepared to step up our efforts to inspect and interdict shipping that we suspect of being in violation of their obligations. And that's why we're prepared to look at a wide range of measures in the United Nations Security Council and elsewhere.
And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking tough, saying the U.S. will protect its allies in the region.
I want to underscore the commitments that the United States has and intends always to honor for the defense of South Korea and Japan. That is part of our alliance obligation, which we take very seriously.
Margaret Tolliff, what's the sense in the White House? Do they see this simmering down, still on the heating up track? How are they looking out on the North Korean challenge?
I think to some extent they're as confounded by North Korea as the rest of us. What they're doing also to some extent, which is a little bit of a change in different, I think, is acknowledging more openly that it matters what other countries, in this case precisely China, want to do in terms of getting a handle on the problem. And I think as President Obama prepares to head to Saudi and to Egypt next week for a different sort of visit, the same dynamic is at play with regard to an Israeli-Palestinian peace solution. I think also there is an explicit acknowledgement that the United States will not be very successful acting alone, that he views the U.S. role as more of one of trying to engage and coalesce people with a more direct geographic stake in whatever situation to take action that the U.S. would support them. And to me, that's what I see going on here.
Ron, how do you read it? There are regional issues, and you've got big players all around North Korea, China, the south of Korea, Japan. But then the U.S., looking at North Korea, it's a straight in everybody's face nuclear weapons test, a pretty good size one. Meanwhile, Iran sits watching in the distance, maybe judging how the U.S. responds here. How do you see this administration looking at this challenge, Ron?
Well, I think the first point is that this North Korea, over time, ever more clearly becomes a problem that you manage, not one that you hope to solve. You know, this is the third president, consecutive president, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and now Obama, who have faced variations of this challenge. And it is a formidable one, and one in which our own direct levers are limited. And to the extent there is a positive out of this, probably the only thing we've seen in the last few days that is positive is the unusual degree to which Chinese voices and governmental sources have been sharply critical of this, suggesting that they are disappointed and resistant as well to North Korea rattling sabers to this extent. Now, to what extent that Chinese displeasure translates into support for tougher sanctions remains unclear, but it does suggest the possibility of enlisting them to be more useful in trying to exert pressure on the North Koreans, and they are the ones who have the most pressure to exert.
Let's get a call from Ron in Augusta, Georgia. Ron, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on what I've actually read, and the two comments I've read that need to be restated is that if we give him, if we respond too forcefully, we're giving him what he wants.
Kim Jong-il, the North Korean leader.
Mm-hmm. Right. If we respond with a shrug, in other words, think about it. What are sanctions going to do? He's already starved his people, okay? So economic sanctions won't work. So what are we going to do? If we do nothing, and actually we have to do something in the UN and with the group of nations, but because we are the United States, but reality, we do not need to do anything to this guy.
Ron, let us look at that. Jack Beatty, what about a shrug, a whack, a tailored sanctions that hit the elite is something I've seen out there. What do you say, Jack?
I think Ron really has a very good point that there is a way in which North Korea uses fear. That's what it. That's its instrument. We become afraid. We become blackmailed. They want a concession, and if we don't evince fear, then we to that degree we lower the psychological stakes. So I do think there's been an element here of overreaction on the part of the Obama administration, just simply in terms of the tactics. And I see that Secretary Gates has been taking a more moderate line on this. Exactly. I mean, what will sanctions do? Sanctions might precipitate the sort of refugee flows to the north that China could never find acceptable. But the crucial thing here is the Iran connection. There does appear to be a confluence of interests here and a complementarity of technological capabilities between these countries. That is, Iran could use what North Korea has done and vice versa, and any connection between those two would be bad business. How to stop it, that's another question.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. court jokes, gay marriage, and spelling bee drama this week. Jay Leno hosts his last Tonight Show tonight, joking to the end. Here he is on Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor.
Now, if confirmed, she would be the country's first Hispanic judge. In fact, her first order of business, deporting Lou Dobbs. That's what she said to me.
California's high court upheld a gay marriage ban. Critics protested.
Gay, straight, black, white, marriage is a civil right. Gay, straight, black, white, marriage is a civil right.
But the sentiments that led to the California ban in the first place have not gone away.
Gay marriage will always be abnormal. It'll always be weird. It'll always be strange. So no matter what the legislation is, that's the sad truth about it.
And last night, Kavya Shiva Shankar, a 13-year-old from Olathe, Kansas, won the Scripps National Spelling Bee. Her final word, Laodicean.
L-A-O-D-I-C-E-A-N, Laodicean.
You are our champion.
And there's a champion. That is great stuff to watch. We're looking at a big week in the news. GM in bankruptcy, North Korea's nuke, Sotomayor, and much more. Ron Brownstein is with us from the Atlantic Media Publishers, writes in the National Journal, and more. Margaret Tolib is here, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and our own Jack Beatty. We've got more listeners on North Korea. Christian in Boston. You're on the air, Christian.
Hi. I had a question about the Obama administration's take on taking the lead of South Korea, especially because Kim Jong-bok, the current president, has a much more oppositional take towards North Korea. And with Roh Moo-hyun's suicide, what does that mean for the Obama administration's role in taking South Korea's lead instead of being the leader in this issue? I'll take the answer off the air.
Christian, thank you very much. I don't know if we're thoroughly plugged in enough on that. Of course, there was the tragic story of the former president, Roh Moo-hyun, throwing himself to his death a week ago in the midst of a corruption probe. But we've got a new leader there now. As you say, Jack, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates kind of playing it down. But the Army's top officer, General George Casey, was asked directly if American forces, there are 28,000 in South Korea, would be prepared to fight if war broke out between South and North. He replied, the short answer is yes. But then he said it would take a little longer to shift gears away from the kind of counterinsurgency that's been going on now. He said normally that might take 90 days, but it doesn't mean, he said, it would take 90 days to effectively fight the North's million-man army. Even getting into all that is kind of scary and wild, Jack. We hope that that's not what's coming, but maybe.
Yeah, I wonder about that sort of talk, and I've even seen reports that there have been alerts of the troops and so on. You know, wars can start out of inadvertence, and if there is a complicated politics being worked out in North Korea having to do with showing resolve, with, you know, having maximum leverage on future talks by threatening us, or perhaps even having to do, as Robert Kaplan surmises, with China politics, that they're trying to show their freedom from China, or perhaps vice versa, that China is influencing. Who knows? Whatever it is, you don't want in any way to have the possibility of inadvertent escalation. And so I think that that sort of military talk should be tamped down. After all, you know, what is it? Is it 10,000 artillery tubes are targeted on Seoul? There's no military solution there. So even to talk in terms of military might or even in terms of deterring, I don't think that's useful.
But there have been a couple of times in the last decade when there were actually, you know, clashes between North and South. They stayed contained. Let's get a call from Des Moines, Iowa. And Sue. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to maybe reiterate what a previous caller said and some disappointment with Obama. I understand that his approval ratings are still very high. But as a very strong Obama supporter, I was a little disappointed initially when he appointed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. I think we cannot emphasize enough the importance of reestablishing a reputation with international affairs. I think we've already missed very important opportunities with admonishing Israel for their behavior on transgressing, again, on the human rights of everybody around them. I mean, for a country that we have supported for decades, we give millions, if not billions, to sustain their military annually. We could have something more responsible to say.
Sue, we've got it. I guess let's look at, maybe in that regard, the visit last week. It was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This week, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas at the White House. Here he is in a joint appearance yesterday with President Obama, saying that He, the Palestinian leader, was still pushing to meet conditions of the so-called roadmap for peace.
Mr. President, you refer to the international commitment as the stipulated in the roadmap. I would like to take this opportunity to reaffirm to you that we are fully committed to all of our obligations under the roadmap, from the A to the Z.
Fully committed A to Z, says Abbas. In the same appearance, the President, Obama, spoke about the urgency of moving forward on this issue.
I want to see progress made, and we will work very aggressively to achieve it. I don't want to put an artificial timetable, but I do share President Abbas's feelings, and I believe that many Israelis share the same view, that time is of the essence, that we can't continue with the drift, with the increased fear and resentments on both sides, the sense of hopelessness around the situation that we've seen for many years now.
Margaret Taleb, on the settlements front in particular, that is, Israeli settlers in the West Bank and Jerusalem, things getting kind of tough here. The president spoke this week with the Abbas visit about stopping settlements, and Sue's critical of Hillary Clinton, though Hillary Clinton elaborated very tough on that. The Secretary of State said Obama wants to see a stop to settlements, not some settlements, not outposts, not natural growth exceptions. That's sort of right in the face all. And the Netanyahu government is pushing back so far this week and saying, well, that's not the way we see it, but there's a kind of fork in the road here.
That's right. Both Obama yesterday and Obama in his previous meeting with Netanyahu expressed his position that enough is enough with the settlements. I think Clinton used stronger language and came out stronger. And I think the question mark is, so what are you going to do about it, right? And I don't know whether he's talking to Netanyahu privately about what the consequences are going to be. He's not publicly, explicitly laying out consequences. And I think when he gives his speech in Cairo, that is going to be something that much of the Arab Muslim audience is going to be listening for. I mean, I think he has to talk about a two-state solution. He has to talk about no more settlements. But I'm sure many in that audience would like to hear him go the next step and say, or else, X, Y, Z.
Some big question marks on that front as Obama prepares to head to the Middle East next week for his big speech in Cairo. Dan in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually really interested in Obama's declaration that he wanted the halt of settlements in the West Bank. And my point really is that, really calling back to what Jack was saying about political capital, I think that I really do hope that Obama is going to judge the political climate within the pro-Zionist lobby in the United States right now. Because I see, at least from my standpoint, that there's a real big divide within the Zionist lobby between supporting the much more conservative perspectives of Israeli citizens and Netanyahu in general, and really trying to work against like the threat of the demographic time bomb. And I think that if he puts pressure and convinces a lot of American Zionists that that this is the best for Israel, he has an opportunity of really taking a harder line than some previous presidents have been able to.
Dan, let us look at it. Strong feelings on all sides with this one. Ron Brownstein, what about the president, his capital, and this issue?
Right. Well, the overall framework of American politics in terms of how we relate to Israel has shifted significantly over the last 20 years from George H.W. Bush and James Baker, who were willing to be quite confrontational with Israel, withhold financial aid, as I recall, over settlements. Both parties have become more reluctant to confront Israel over the last 18 years and to challenge the Israeli government's sort of prescription of what it needs to do to provide security. But within that overall shift, I do think Obama is going to be at the most confrontational end, potentially, of this kind of less confrontational framework. He is someone who has ideas about how this moves forward. Those ideas probably clash pretty clearly with Netanyahu, and that is going to be a very difficult, if not dysfunctional, partnership. I don't know how long the White House believes Netanyahu will be there, but certainly as long as he is there, it is going to be difficult. It is going to be a difficult relationship for Obama, just as it was between Clinton and Netanyahu. And people I've talked to have said that they don't really expect it to be much better than it was then. So I think what you will see is Obama pushing against Netanyahu, but I think in the context of what's happened over the last 20 years, resisting the kind of complete break that George H.W. Bush and James Baker were willing to risk. And so you're going to see something that may not satisfy those who are at the kind of the peace now end of the U.S. spectrum on this debate, but it's probably going to raise hackles among many of the neoconservatives and others who want kind of an unfettered alliance between the U.S. And Israel and define a proper U.S. role as supporting essentially what Israel decides. I think Obama wants a more independent role for the U.S. as sort of a more of an honest broker than we've seen certainly from under the last president.
Much more to come on that front as the president arrives next week, as you say, Margaret, in Cairo. Let's get a call from Norwich, Connecticut, and Jenna. Jenna, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I just had a comment on the gay marriage in California, the battle brewing over there. My brother is gay, openly gay, and I do not understand why people make such a big fuss over what people do behind their own doors and in their own private lives. Do people really go home and sit and think about the next person's relationship? I mean, I don't understand why people can't just let people be happy and get the same rights that straight people get and married couples get. It just bothers me that people really have so much hatred over this issue and all these things that I've heard on the radio from California coming out, and it boggles me.
And you know it firsthand from your brother's own experience as a gay American. Jack, I want to hear you on this, but there's a little tape I might run here. This is from Theodore Olson, of all people, former Solicitor General under President George W. Bush, who famously took the 2000 election to the Supreme Court, representing George W. Bush. And now he has joined forces to try to overturn the same state gay marriage ban that was upheld by California's high state court last week. Here he is in a news conference, Ted Olson, saying it's time for equal rights.
For too long, gay men and lesbians who seek stable, committed, loving relationships within the institution of marriage have been denied that fundamental right that the rest of us freely enjoy.
But not this week, not in California, Jack.
Not in California, no. A 6-1 opinion that some people found very strained because, of course, these same justices had judges had affirmed the right earlier in 2008. In the Chief Justice Ronald George, in his opinion, he speaks of the measure carves out a narrow and limited exception to these state constitutional rights. And, you know, a narrow and limited exception, is that really what's at stake here? I mean, if this were applied to some other group, would we say it's a narrow and limited exception? In the brief that that Ted Olson, along with David Boies, who was the other side of Bush v. Gore litigation, in their brief, they are asking a federal court to enjoin this ruling and to reinstate gay marriage. And in their brief, they say that the rejection by voters, quote, is an utterly this restriction as the narrow exception is an utterly irrational restriction, premised on nothing more than longstanding misconception and prejudice. And they go on in their brief to quote from a number of Supreme Court decisions that you can just see they're lining this case up for the Supreme Court. They quote from one on the question of, people say, marriage is traditional. It's always been between a man and a woman. They quote from a court case, quote, neither the antiquity of a practice nor the fact of steadfast legislative and judicial adherence to it through centuries insulates it from constitutional attack. They quote from another ruling, freedom to marry has long been recognized as a vital personal right essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness. You see here, we're shaping a equal protection of the laws, a 14th Amendment challenge, not just to the California ruling, but to the restrictions and the constitutional limitations in 27 states. And that is just over the horizon of the future for the Supreme Court.
Maybe to the Supreme Court. Margaret, do we have any idea where Sonia Sotomayor stands on the gay marriage issue, if she should be the next justice there?
I don't know where she stands on the issue. I know that she's divorced and has no children. But I think what Jack just said is very interesting, the idea that if I understood what you were saying right, the idea that marriage could eventually be seen as a privacy right comparable to abortion, in which case the 5-4 decisions get even more interesting.
Oh boy.
To me, I see this as a generational issue, Miss California notwithstanding. I think society's expectations and understanding of what marriage means have evolved so much from arranged situations and sort of social status situations to a choice, to the issue of love, to how society deals with divorce or people living together who are unwed, interracial marriages. I think this is a continuum, and this is, you know, people care about this institution, and, you know, I just think society's already changed in the way it views this continuum and will probably continue to do so. But politicians are not usually ones to get ahead of the curve on issues like this. Mm. And I think the courts are reluctant to do so also.
Maybe in their lap anyway. One more little bit of tape. Our time is so short, but here's Illinois Senator Roland Burris talking on a wiretap, federal wiretap, to Governor Rob Blagojevich's brother Rob, about raising money for the governor. This is when he also asks for the Senate seat.
I will personally do something, okay?
Okay. All right, Roy.
And it'll be done before the 15th of December.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Hey, okay. You're a good friend. I'll pass on your message.
Please do, and
okay.
Tell Rod to keep me in mind.
Keep me in mind. I will do something. Ron Brownstein, does Roland Burris hang on to that U.S. Senate seat or not? What do you think?
What a mess. Either he does hold on, he's a very flawed candidate in the general election, or you have to beat an African-American senator in a Democratic primary and create all those wounds for November. Two difficult scenarios for Democrats, and in fact, one of several difficult scenarios that have been created by all these vacancies associated with the Obama victory. So I think it's a very tough circumstance for Democrat. It's hard to imagine him being the senator again when the next Congress convenes.
Or whether he'll last. A lot of tape to listen to right there this week in the whole country listening. Ron Brownstein with Atlantic Media Publishers and the National Journal, author of The Second Civil War. Always great to have you, Ron. Thanks so much
glad
for being
here
today. Margaret, you're off to the Middle East next week with the president?
I am.
Good travels.
Looking forward to it.
Well,
thank
I hope
you.
We talk on the other side. And Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being here. Have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You have a great weekend, too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.